The kings of Macedonia, Alexander the Great, Alexander in Egypt. Now, Alexander and his party arrived at the temple at Siwa, dust-stained and weary, and the mysteriousness of the shrine compound can only have been reinforced after the journey through such desolate country. The senior priest was waiting outside and greeted Alexander as son of Ammon, or son of Zeus, which may have reflected his new status as pharaoh, although one tradition claimed it was a slip of the tongue by a man unused to Greek. Ptolemy and Aristobulus, both whom were in the party, do not appear to have gone into the detail about what happened once Alexander was alone, accompanied by the priest. For Arian says no more than that he made his inquiry of the god, and received the answer his heart desired, as he said, and turned back for Egypt. Not even the means by which the oracle gave its answer is certain, whether it was an ancient Egyptian method whereby a sacred boat carried on the shoulders of the priest was made to move in various ways, or a priest using gestures and facial expressions rather than words, like that in some Greek shrines. Plutarch cites a letter from Alexander to Olympias that in itself may or may not be genuine, claiming that he learned secrets that he would reveal only to her and only in person on his return to Macedonia. Something, of course, he was never to do, but a message at least compatible with the public version of the answer that pleased him, and hinting that this confirmed his supposed belief that his father was divine. Alexander certainly paid more attention in future to Zeus Ammon than the other gods associated with his new empire. Other traditions swiftly grew up, imagined by the authors unable to resist the encounter between the king and the oracle of his divine father, and tend to run along similar lines. He is supposed to have asked whether he would rule the world, to which the answer was affirmative. Another question was whether his father's murderers had all been punished, only to be told that his true father was divine, but that Philip's assassins had all paid for their crime. All of these details are likely to have been invented after his death. The visit to Siwa was clearly a great personal importance to Alexander. Otherwise, he wouldn't have made the long journey, and was at very least an additional reason for taking Egypt. Witnesses heard the priest address him as the son of God, or at least believe that's what he said. And for the rest of his life, Alexander sometimes openly refers to himself as son of Ammon or son of Zeus Ammon, and let himself be called son of Zeus by others, including Aristotle's nephew, Callisthenes, who was writing the official version of the expedition. He was not invariably referred to in this way, nor does it mean a renunciation of Philip. Greek heroes could have both a divine and a human father, the god joining in conception in some mystical way. It was another sign that Alexander wanted to be seen and probably saw himself as special, different from other kings, including his father. Something his spectacular successes proclaimed. Leaving the oasis behind him, he returned to Egypt, and soon the war with Darius. In 32 to 31 BCE, Alexander spent more than 4 months in Egypt. In contrast to the two winters, there was no major sign of major campaigning. For the first time, the king and his soldiers had a break from fighting, which does not mean they were inactive. The visit to Siwa tends to dominate our sources. Although it took no more than a few weeks, nothing suggests that the experience was marked by any visible or immediate transformation of the king's character or behavior, in spite of all the fascination shown in later generations. Both before and after the pilgrimage, most of his time was spent in administration, organizing his new conquest, preparing the next campaign, and receiving delegations from allies and subjects alike. Two Egyptian noblemen were selected to become senior civil officers, or nomarchs, but one declined the honor for reasons that are not specified. It made practical sense to secure as much goodwill as possible amongst a wider population, especially the elite, and time and effort was spent in showing them and their customs respect. Yet Alexander was a conqueror, perhaps better behaved than some of the Persians in the past, but still a foreign invader, and there's no reason for Egyptians to love him. Garrisons, mainly of mercenaries, were to stay, and their commander was drawn from his companions, overwhelmingly Macedonian noblemen with a handful of Greeks, as were the financial and civil overseers with authority greater than the nomarch. This was the pattern everywhere, with all significant posts going to men selected from his court, and each decision made by the king based on his willingness to trust an individual. A few months later, the errant treasurer, Orphalus, returned from Greece, and Alexander's old friend was readmitted to favor in the high office. Some time was spent in Memphis, where numerous embassies from Greek cities were given audience by a king inclined to be generous in his decisions. He held a festival, including a sacrifice to Zeus the king, with athletic and artistic competitions. This quintessentially Hellenic celebration was matched by equally Greek curiosity, and at some point an expedition was sent south along the Nile to discover the cause of the annual flooding, and its conclusion no doubt passed from Callisthenes to his uncle, led Aristotle to declare that the matter was settled. Alongside the exploration and the celebration came a moment of tragedy, when a small boat carrying some of the king's younger friends overturned in the Nile. Hector, the youngest known son of Parmenio, managed to struggle to the bank, only to collapse from exhaustion and die. Alexander was said to be very fond of the young man, and this, along with his father's importance, ensured that he was given a magnificent funeral. In early April, 331 BCE, Alexander marched out, crossing the Nile and its canals on the bridges he had constructed. Now the sources for this, The Politics by Aristotle, The Histories by Herodotus, Histories, 12 volumes, by Diodorus Siculus, Peloponnesian War by Thucydides, and The Lives by Plutarch, Philip and Alexander, Kings and Conquerors by Goldsworthy, History of Macedonia, Volume 1 and Volume 2 by Hammond, In the Shadow of Olympus, The Emergence of Macedonia by Borgia. Some additional sources for the sections on Alexander rules would include, of course, Arians, The Campaigns of Alexander, In the Footsteps of Alexander the Great by Michael Wood, The Wars of Alexander the Great by Haeckel, and The Story of Alexander's Empire by Mahaffey. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.